This is Paul, and I'll be reading from the June 2026 National Geographic magazine, an article entitled, The Last Lions of Gir. Decades after nearly going extinct, the world's only existing population of Asiatic lions is now overrunning a small reserve in western India, bringing them into closer contact with humans and each other. Now what? Written by Sharon Gunup. The lion was injured badly. He looked like a prize fighter, with old scars, new scratches, and fur missing beside his left eye. An open wound gaped along his spine. He'd been rushed by ambulance to the lion hospital from India's Gir National Park, where he'd fought with a resident male, probably in a turf war. He was furious, lunging against the bars and roaring at ear-splitting decibels. The medical team quickly transferred him to a, quote, squeeze cage, end quote, cranking the sides inward to immobilize him. He lowered his head. His roars softened. Paresh Vetter, the head veterinarian, donned surgeon's gear and quickly inserted an IV into the lion's tail, injecting pain meds and antibiotics. His team attended to wounds they could reach without being mauled, and then wheeled him off to a quieter enclosure, away from other impatient lions and leopards. Vadher peeled off his gloves and gave us an update. The cat would remain at the hospital under observation for about a week. Then hopefully he'd be leased back into the park. There he would rejoin the world's last Asiatic lions, which live only here in Gujarat, a western state of India along the Arabian Sea. But this isn't another tragic tale of a magnificent animal's demise. A century ago, only a handful of Asiatic lions remained, but extraordinary conservation efforts, with substantial financial support from the Indian government, have brought them back from near extinction. As of the 2025 census, there were 891. Their future, though, is not yet secure. Saving a large carnivore like the Asiatic lion in the world's most populous country, home to 1.5 billion people, is extremely complicated. With lions, next-level challenges loom. About 44% live outside protected areas, with some wandering through villages and cities, preying on livestock and, on rare occasions, attacking people. Some wildlife experts believe a single cataclysm, cyclone, flood, wildfire, or virus, could derail the lion's miraculous recovery. Quote, we have all the eggs in one basket, end quote, said Yavedendra Jala, former dean of the Wildlife Institute of India's, who's spent 30 years studying Asiatic lions. They need more protected space. And right now, the last of their kind are living on a peninsula that juts into the Arabian Sea. The cat's rebound represents, quote, a great conservation success story, end quote, says Moham Ram, then deputy conservator of forests for the Gujarat Forest Department, who has worked in Gir since 2018. But along with that success comes a critical question. What will it take to ensure the lion's long-term survival? Few people realize that the lions in Africa, we all know, have cousins that reside in India. These, quote, modern lions, end quote, diverged into separate lineages some 70,000 years ago. Zoologists have divided the lion kingdom into 11 subspecies. But genetic evidence proves there are just two. Panthera leo Melanochthyi, which lives in eastern and southern Africa, and Panthera leo-leo, which is found in central and west Africa, and in a genetically distinct subpopulation in India, the Asiatic lion. Panthera leo-leo once roamed from North Africa's coastal forest through northern Greece, across Mesopotamia and Persia, reaching India at least 15,000 years ago. And everywhere these lions have gone, they've been revered, feared, and persecuted. The King of Beasts has captured the human imagination throughout history, symbolizing strength, power, valor, and nobility. That's why hunting lions was a glamorous royal pastime for millennia, dating back to the Sumerian period and continuing into modern times with India's princely rulers and the British Raj. They've adorned cathedrals, city gates, and grand public buildings. Asiatic lions graced Persia's imperial seals. They've been venerated by Hindus for thousands of years. In the ancient Sanskrit Vedic texts, a centaur-like half-man, half-lion named Narasimha appears as an incarnation of the god Vishnu. One of the Hindu warrior goddesses Durga's celestial mounts was a lion. And in 1947, the lion became the new Republic of India's national emblem. To this day, meeting a lion is considered auspicious, a visit from the divine, and this history is a major factor in the animal's rebound. Quote, "The lions in Gur have learned to live with humans, and the humans have learned to live with lions," end quote, Jala says. Remarkable efforts and innovation over many years averted this cat's near demise. The Indian government established Gur Sanctuary in 1965, and part was declared a national park in 1975. The Forest Department assembled a mass guard force to eliminate poaching. Starting in 2019, the department adopted high-tech monitoring, built more wildlife hospitals, and increased community programs. Lions have also benefited from residing in Prime Minister's Narendra Modi's home state of Gujarat, where they are a tremendous source of local pride and tourist revenue. The state government allocated over $40 million for their protection between 2021 and 2024. The combined impact? After more than two decades of critically endangered status, Asiatic lions were downlisted to endangered in 2008. Then new genetic studies recategorized them into the Panthera leo-leo subspecies. When reassessed in 2025, these lions were still listed as endangered. Some wildlife experts, like Jala, feel it will be difficult for the cats to ever truly be safe as long as they live within a single region. A wake-up call came in 2018. When highly contagious canine distemper, likely spread by stray dogs, took down at least 23 lions. It's the same virus that killed about 1,000 lions in Africa's Serengeti ecosystem in 1994. The specter of disease spurred the construction of a dedicated hospital complex for treating Asiatic lions. Whenever possible, Vadhir, the lead vet, treats his wild patients, from lions, leopards, and langur monkeys to spotted deer, pythons, and crocodiles in the field. But critical cases are rushed to any of 11 hospitals, which double as rescue centers. The Serengeti outbreak reignited long-standing efforts to find a second home for India's lions. In 2013, the Indian Supreme Court mandated, quote, urgent steps, end quote, to relocate a pride. Officials, following the recommendation of wildlife biologist Ravi Chellam, identified an area in Kuno National Park in the neighboring state of Madhya Pradesh as the ideal spot. To make way for lions, the state government moved 24 villages out of the park. But a pride was never settled there. Instead, the state government rehabilitated Bardar Wildlife Sanctuary, some 90 miles from Gur. Some experts, including Chellam, suggest that they may not be far enough away to mitigate a preventable tragedy like the canine distemper deaths. Quote, distance provides the required buffer, end quote, he says. Quote, catastrophe can strike, end quote. On my first day in Jugarat in December 2024, we drove into the park as dawn blanched the sky. The terrain was thick with vines, spiky acacia, and nearly bare teak trees. Saja Manjaraya, one of the park's leading trackers and our guide, scanned for Asiatic lions in the nascent light. The wind was strung with birdsong. Gur is a biodiverse wonder, home to 338 avian species alone, as well as 41 types of mammals and more than 631 plants and trees. A herd of spotted deer regarded us warily as we passed. Acrobatic langurs bounced through branches above us. One clutched an infant. We spotted flocking plum-headed parakeets, wild boars, a scampering mongoose, and a tall antlered sambar, its rump more horse than deer. Peacocks perched and paraded everywhere. And then I saw them. A lioness, nearly camouflaged in flaxen grass, with her tiny three-month-old cub. We killed the engine. The lioness was vigilant, but regal, mostly ignoring us. At first glance, she bore a close resemblance to her cousins in Africa. But then I noticed differences. She was slightly smaller, with a distinctive belly fold that reminded me of sagging skin following weight loss, and her profile was a bit more elongated. The baby leaped on her head, gnawed her ears, licked her face, and tugged at her flicking tufted tail. Finally, she was swatted back. She was about 10. She'd lost one of her two cubs, which is not unusual. About 30% of cubs do not survive to adulthood, Jala says. So she was her offspring's only playmate. They rolled and chased for a delightful half hour. The lioness froze, listening. She roared, her blast reaching a deafening crescendo before quieting to a short, guttural grunts. Perhaps she was calling to her pride. She sauntered into the forest and disappeared, put her cub trailing close behind. In the ensuing months, there was a baby boom. When I returned the following March, we encountered a staggeringly large pride. Four females and their 10 cubs. Two males were nearby, the only lions in this group that have been given names. Jai, the king, and Viru. The males slept sprawled in a thicket through the afternoon heat. Even in the dense growth, one could see their tails had bigger tufts, and their manes, though scantier than those of their cousins in Africa, had the Asiatic lion's trademark, a slim mohawk running from crown to mid-back. But the most striking difference is how these gregarious cats organize their communities. In Africa, a group of males lives with an extended family of females and cubs. In Gur, the two sexes lead mostly separate lives. Two or more lionesses form a pride, raising and protecting their cubs at times in a communal creche. They're affectionate families, always greeting each other nose to nose, or nuzzling faces before plopping down together. The males buddy up in a coalition of 2 to 6 relatives. They protect and procreate, a few prides, but one male reigns supreme. The females also mate with males from different coalitions, but for them it's a strategy to protect their cubs. With males confused about who fathered a litter, they're less likely to kill the young ones, Jala's research showed. Lions don't tolerate another male's offspring. These cubs will remain with their family until they're 2 or 3 years old. Then the subadult females will merge into a pride, while the subadult males will strike out on their own. Researchers tracked one young male that walked about 65 miles over 6 months. Lions need substantial territory, and Gur's 4 sanctuaries and the national park are clearly filling up. Today, an estimated 44% of Gur's lions live outside preserves in a human-dominated mosaic of farmlands, roads, railways, towns, and cities. Managing them requires a 21st-century conservation paradigm. Wildlife monitoring strategies in Gur including outfitting park rangers with handheld digital mapping tools that allow them to geotag and share what's happening inside the preserve in real time. They're part of a suite of devices that are invaluable, Ram says, because, quote, ecological complexities and human-wildlife interactions continue to evolve, and technology offers vital tools to better understand, monitor, and preserve this unique ecosystem, end quote. To see this firsthand, National Geographic explorer and photographer Steve Winter and I spent a day with Gur's high-tech monitoring unit at an air-conditioned mothership of computers, hard drives, and large-screen monitors. Scientific officer Laha Jala showed us how they track the 6 lions they've outfitted with GPS collars around the clock. He clicked through GIS maps overlaid with zigzagging multicolored lines showing where the cats go, where they live, and the corridors they travel. It's crucial information needed for conservation and patrolling. Officials have also had to address a concerning threat. Railway lines cut through the greater Gur landscape, and lions have been hit by trains. This prompted a mandate from the High Court of Gujarat for trains to slow down in wildlife areas. Now, whenever a lion crosses geofencing near tracks, the tech staff alerts the railway department, stopping trains if necessary. These efforts have significantly reduced the number of accidents in recent years. Additionally, the tech team members are compiling a, quote, Facebook, end quote, of Gur's lions. They're using AI tools to identify individuals from photographs by analyzing their unique vibrasa patterns, whisker spots on their muzzles, and facial scars or other marks. As of December 2025, they'd cataloged 354 lions, some 2/5 of the known population. The Forest Department also monitors a critical stretch of highway near the park. When optical or thermal cameras detect animals nearby, LED displays warn motorists to slow down. Sensors track each vehicle's speed, flashing it, along with the license plate number, on a roadside screen. Live feed CCTV surveils the park's entry and exit points. A GPS system tracks every tourist safari vehicle in the park. And in 300 villages, paid informants act as eyes and ears. Everything, it seems, is monitored in Gur. Officials are formalizing an, quote, eco-sensitive zone, end quote, around the national park and 3 sanctuaries. A shock absorber barring mining, factories, and pollution while allowing for animal movement. The last serious poaching incident occurred in 2007, when 8 lions were killed for their claws, bones, and canine teeth. Valuable items on the Asian black market. That strategy sparked greater protections. Today, more than 600 officers patrol the region. About a third are women, dubbed, quote, the Lion Queens of India, end quote, in a 2015 documentary series of the same name. This is one of the few places on Earth with zero poaching, according to RAM. A report from the IUCN found that India's lions are 20.5 times safer than their counterparts in Africa. More lions are now living in close proximity to the people of Gujarat, where 100 villages lie within 3 miles of Gir National Park, along with some 4,300 semi-nomadic Malhari herders who live inside the adjoining sanctuary. But now, lions are broaching new territory where people haven't lived with them and in generations may not have the same tolerance or caution. On average, Asiatic lions mauled 12 people and killed one person each year from 2020 through 2024, RAM says. But halfway through 2025, the lions had already been linked to at least 5 deaths. In February, a lion mauled a 7-year-old boy. In March, a lioness killed a farmer working his fields and a man was partially eaten, found surrounded by lion pug marks. In May, it was a 22-year-old man. In June, a 5-year-old boy. The families will receive about 1 million rupees from the government, the equivalent of about $11,000. We met with a survivor, Tabhai Makwana, in his tiny village outside the park. A slim man of about 55, he looked decades older. Some 30 years ago, a lioness killed a cow and was chased away from a neighboring village. She then encountered Makwana working in his field and ambushed him from behind, seeking her deep claws into his back and buttocks. He called it, quote, the worst experience of my life, mentally and physically, end quote. His neighbors heard his screams and raced him to the hospital where he spent a week. The medical bills took a huge financial toll on his family. Back then, there was no government help. Makwana was permanently crippled, and he lives in constant pain. And yet, in our conversation, when asked about the significance of the lions, he said, quote, I still have immense respect for the big cats, end quote. The lions are a fact of life in Gir. Many villagers are far more worried about the leopards that also live here, which can be more dangerous. Malhadis have lived on this land since the late 1800s, though thousands were relocated when the national park was created in 1975. With fewer cows and buffalo grazing, sambars and other prey rebounded. Within the protected area, the lion's diet is now 74% wild, a dramatic change from the 1970s when the lions mostly survived on livestock. But they still kill about 2,100 farm animals each year. The government now compensates farmers to keep them from retaliating. Higher sums for milk-producing females. Less for a young or an old animal. Still not quite at market prices, but better than they once were. We learned that a lion had killed Madhari's buffalo the night before. So we headed to his nest, a temporary settlement made of mud and thatch for an extended family of about 60, to observe the compensation process. As we arrived, 2 female guards, dressed in crisp beige uniforms and jaunty berets, dismounted from their motorcycle. A gaggle of children surrounded them as they sat down with the clan's elder, Bahrabi Vejadabi Alwa, who was wearing an ivory-colored stocking cap and a traditional white cotton kurta that glowed bright in the sunlight. They spoke in Gujarati, the guards filling out seemingly endless forms. Their mutual respect was palpable. Alwa pulled out a cell phone, showing evidence that included photos of himself besides his half-eaten buffalo. Finally, he signed papers with an X. He's illiterate, but wealthy. The herd's rich milk commands good prices, and the family lives here and grazes its animals cost-free. Some farmers welcome the lions because they hunt deer, nilgays, and wild pigs that devour their crops. The Forest Department's community programs help foster coexistence by installing solar streetlights, digging bore wells, and vaccinating livestock. The department has also built 14,500 metal makan platforms for farmers to watch safely over their fields. The ultimate goal is to create a system that allows the lions to thrive while keeping local communities healthy and safe. But now, Gur's lions are moving across 13,514 square miles, an area about the size of Taiwan, and their numbers continue to grow. With every cub born, conservation becomes more complex. Quote, social carrying capacity, end quote, will ultimately determine the extent of their rebound. Javadendrav Jala says, quote, the cost-benefit of having lions in your neighborhood, end quote. More broadly, preserving the huge tracts that lions need to survive protects the entire spectrum of life they live beside. That land sequesters water needed by millions of people. Forested lands provide a buffer against flooding and pull carbon from the atmosphere. Quote, under the umbrella of this flagship species, end quote, Ram says, quote, we are conserving this ecosystem, end quote. On my final day in Gur last April, we spotted Jai and Veru lying under a bush, sleeping through the brutal 107-degree pre-monsoon season heat. The land looked almost post-apocalyptic, bare and desiccated. The rivers that had gushed in December, now dry. Climate change is hitting India hard, with soaring temperatures and humidity, unpredictable monsoons, and increasing torrential downpours. It again raised the issue of how to best ensure the long-term survival of these lions. While Bengal tigers have 58 reserves spread across the nation, Jala says, Indians' lions have just one national park to themselves, without people. For the world's last 891 Asiatic lions, and counting, there's still Gur. The end. This is Paul. I'll be reading an article from the National Geographic magazine, written by Stacy Colino, entitled Debunking the Shade Against Nightshade Vegetables and Inflammation. If there's one category of food that experts says gets unfairly maligned, it's nightshades. Some people avoid eating these fruits and veggies, which include eggplant, bell peppers, potatoes, and tomatoes, based on the theory that they can cause harmful inflammation in the body. The reality is that for the most of us, the opposite is actually true. Quote, there's a belief that these are inflammatory, but there are things in these fruits and vegetables that make them anti-inflammatory, end quote, says Joan Salge Blake, a clinical professor of nutrition at Boston University, and host of the Nutrition and Health podcast, Spot On. Quote, "You don't want to throw this whole category of foods under the bus and demonize them," end quote. Nightshade veggies and fruits are loaded with vitamins, minerals, fiber, and antioxidants, which neutralize harmful, unstable molecules called free radicals that can cause oxidation stress and damage to cells and other vital structures inside the body. Consuming high amounts of antioxidants from food can reduce chronic inflammation in the body. So where did the idea that it's harmful to consume nightshades come from? The answer is based on misinformation and erroneous assumptions about certain compounds they contain. Quote, "It's been frustrating to me over the years why nightshades have been such a persistent concern," end quote, says Nate Wood, an assistant professor of medicine and director of culinary medicine at the Yale School of Medicine. Quote, "Like all vegetables, nightshade vegetables are good for us and they lower inflammation. Like all foods, some people may have specific intolerances to them," end quote. Why are nightshades? What are nightshades and how did they get their bad reputation? Nightshades are from the Solanaceae plant family, which includes more than 2,400 flowering plants. It's a diverse family of plants, some edible and some not, that includes chili peppers, goji berries, tomatillos, pepino melons, spices derived from peppers like paprika or cayenne, and even tobacco. Although potatoes are nightshades, sweet potatoes are not. Many nightshades contain small amounts of nitrogen-based compounds called alkaloids, such as solanine, which protects the plants from insects, fungi, and other threats to their survival. Some people believe alkaloids can aggravate the inflammatory conditions. Quote, "Alkaloids are a category of molecules that are thought to be dirty because they bind to lots of different receptors in the body, so they can have lots of different effects," end quote, says Wood. And indeed, people with certain digestive disorders may be sensitive to the effects of alkaloids. Researchers have suggested that consuming nightshades could be a trigger for worsening gut symptoms associated with irritable bowel syndrome and inflammatory bowel disease. That's because the alkaloid compounds can potentially make the intestinal lining more permeable, as well as activate mast cells in the gut that release inflammatory substances like histamine and cytokines. Even people who don't have one of these conditions may be sensitive to certain alkaloids when they're consumed in large quantities. Quote, "It's very individual. Some people can tolerate tomatoes, but not eggplant," end quote, says Keith Ayub, a registered dietitian nutritionist in New York City and an associate professor emeritus of the pediatrics at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. Quote, "Others can tolerate eggplant, but not other nightshades. For people who are triggered by them, small amounts here and there may be okay," end quote. But alkaloids are considered safe when healthy people consume them in normal amounts. The health benefits of nightshades. In fact, not only are these fruits and veggies safe for most people, they also offer major health benefits. Specifically, tomatoes are rich sources of vitamin C, folate, potassium, and lycopene, a potent antioxidant. A study in 2025 issue of the journal Molecular Nutrition and Food Research found that adding tomato puree to a high-fat meal led to reductions in inflammatory markers among healthy men, compared to when they ate the same meal without the tomato puree. Red bell peppers contain vitamin C, folate, potassium, niacin, selenium, and fiber. Eggplants have plenty of fiber, potassium, and magnesium. Plus, they have anthocyanins, which are anti-inflammatory phytochemicals that give the skin its purple color. Interestingly, the Arthritis Foundation lists nightshade vegetables such as red and green peppers on its list of the best vegetables for arthritis because they are rich in antioxidants and other nutrients that can reduce inflammation throughout the body, including the joints. Fruits and vegetables in the nightshade category are staples in health-promoting diets like the Mediterranean diet, the DASH diet, and the Portfolio diet. Quote, "Where would Italian food be without tomatoes, green and red peppers, potatoes, and eggplant? Or Latin American food without chili peppers, tomatillos, or paprika?" End quote, says Ayub. Quote, "Whole societies have been eating these foods for years." End quote. How to eat nightshades if you're worried about alkaloids. If you suspect nightshades are problematic for you because you experience gas, diarrhea, heartburn, or other forms of gastrointestinal distress after consuming them, the best way to test a proposition is with an elimination diet. For 2 to 4 weeks, avoid eating nightshades. Quote, "Then slowly add them back to your diet, one at a time, week by week, and see what happens," end quote, advises Salja Blake. Quote, "It's like what you would do with a suspected food allergy," end quote. Keep in mind, quote, "Cooking will reduce the alkaloid content, and that could minimize the effects if they bother you," end quote, Salja Blake says. When potatoes are green or have sprouts on them, however, that's an indication that those areas have higher amounts of selenine and could cause digestive distress if you eat them. Wood's advice is to avoid eating them. Compost them instead. Quote, "Or be generous with cutting out that green area or sprout," end quote. The bottom line is, nightshade fruits and veggies deserve a place at the table. Quote, "Nightshades get a lot of heat, and they're actually really good vegetables. They're known for having a ton of nutritional benefits and anti-inflammatory phytochemicals," end quote, says Ayub. Quote, "It's really important not to eliminate foods you don't have to," end quote. The end. This is Paul, and I'll be reading an article from the National Geographic magazine by Joshua Rapp Learn, entitled, "A Hoard of Gold Treasures Reveals the True Power of a Mysterious Bronze Age Civilization." Ancient merchants in Bronze Age Cyprus went out in a full bling, with gold crowns and mouthpieces that might make even modern grills rapper Nelly jealous. New archaeological research has revealed that a series of family tombs in the port city of Hala Sultanateh were filled with fancy jewelry, pottery, and other artifacts from powerful surrounding kingdoms in Egypt, Mycenae, and Anatolia. Quote, "The Cypriots amalgamated various cultures, designs," end quote, says Peter Fisher, an archaeologist at the University of Gothenburg in Sweden. Quote, "By this amalgamation, they created something of their own," end quote. These newly described discoveries reveal not only how well-connected Cyprus was with its peers, but how elite merchants from the island demonstrated their success. Quote, "They are the most spectacular finds that have ever come out of the ground in Cyprus," end quote, says Bernard Knapp, who worked for decades in Cyprus as an archaeologist with the University of Glasgow in Scotland, and was not involved in the new work. Cyprus's role in the Late Bronze Age. Cyprus sat in the middle of several important Eastern Mediterranean civilizations during the region's Late Bronze Age, which lasted from the 17th to the 12th century BC. To the south, Egypt's new kingdom saw a large expansion with great pharaohs like Akhenaten, Tutankhamun, and Ramses II. To the north, the Mycenaeans controlled much of Greece. To the east, the Hittites controlled large swaths of Anatolia and parts of the Levant. But without Cyprus, the Mediterranean Bronze Age wouldn't have existed. To make bronze, you need copper, and Cyprus had plenty of it. Quote, the Cypriots were sitting on a mountain of copper, end quote, Fisher says. Quote, if you count all the mines in Europe, in the Ural and Russia, and in Great Britain, they produce less copper than Cyprus alone, end quote. Yet Cyprus during this period isn't as well known as its neighbors. This is partly because scholars have yet to decipher the writing system used at the time on the island, which somewhat resembles the also undeciphered script of the Minoan civilization on Crete. Most historical knowledge of the island comes from Mesopotamia, accounts that mention Cypriot kings on equal footing with other major ruling civilizations. But details are sparse on the inner workings of the island kingdom. The British Museum began excavating at Hala Sultan Tek in the 1800s, finding tombs and absconding with some artifacts, Fisher says. Archaeologists conducted piecemeal investigations at the port city starting in the 1960s and 70s. In 2014, Fisher and his team discovered a cemetery at the site and began excavating burial chambers, returning for 16 consecutive years. The tombs at Hala Sultan Tek, also known as Dromalaxia Vizakia, are oddly shaped. They look roughly like the number 8, with two connected circular chambers, each about 6 to 10 feet in diameter. Some graves contain dozens of people. One has more than 60 individuals buried inside. Fisher's team has examined DNA from the remains, and their unpublished results reveal that the individuals were siblings, mothers, fathers, and grandparents, with several generations of people buried on top of each other. Quote, these were family tombs, end quote, Fisher says. Golden Cemetery, quote, crowns, end quote, and, quote, grills, end quote. Golden Cemetery crowns and grills. In a recent study published in the Oxford Journal of Archaeology, Fisher describes the grave goods found in some of these family tombs. The most luxurious include 9 golden diadems or crowns covered in patterns with spirals, flowers, ibexes, wild cats, and bulls. 2 individuals were buried with golden mouthpieces, essentially mouth grills that resemble the dental jewelry popularized by hip-hop artists. Graves also contained precious stones, ivory, rings, earrings, and toe rings of gold and silver, as well as some silver figurines, deity pendants, and beautiful pottery made with a tin glaze called phaeacin. The diadems were symbols, status symbols, that showed evidence of wear, indicating they were likely used in life as well as laid to rest with the dead, Fisher says. The mouthpieces, in contrast, show little sign of wear. They were also quite thin, less valuable, leading Fisher to conclude they are only placed on the dead. Marion Feldman, an art historian in Near Eastern Studies at Johns Hopkins University in Maryland, who was not involved in Fisher's study, says that the mouthpieces are common across many cultures. Quote, it almost feels like a quasi-universal need to show the deceased is no longer breathing, and no longer speaking, and no longer eating, end quote, she says. The diadems and mouthpieces sometimes carry motifs from other cultures, such as bull figures common in Egypt. The gold used to make them like he came from Egyptian-controlled Nubia. But like many other locally adapted versions of motifs that originated abroad, Fisher suspects that they were likely produced locally. Feldman agrees with this assessment. Bull motifs in late Bronze Age Cyprus had become, quote, entrenched, end quote, she says, speaking to a local character. The elite and specialized merchants of Bronze Age Cyprus. While some of these artifacts were made on Cyprus, many were not. Each grave tends to favor a unique cultural collection, says Fisher. One grave with multiple individuals buried together, for example, mostly held artifacts made in Egypt. Fisher believes that based on these foreign goods and the fact that Hala Sultan Tek was a port town, the burials were likely elite merchants, each who specialized in trading with a particular region of the Mediterranean. Quote, the site is of exceptional archaeological importance, end quote, said the Cyprus Department of Antiquities in a statement. Quote, the material uncovered there also offers clear testimony to Cyprus's active participation in extensive long-distance exchange networks, end quote. Some goods came from neighboring cultures. Silver figurines and flasks were likely imported from Anatolia. Greek goods include bronze knives with ivory handles, mugs, and other ceramics, the most striking being a rattan, a type of drinking flask. Other material comes from further abroad, including ceramics from the Nuragig culture based in modern-day Sardinia, lapis lazuli from Afghanistan, carnelian from India, and Baltic amber. Fisher says that some of these goods from farther afield likely arrived indirectly, not through direct trade. For Feldman, the ostentatious graves offer more evidence that Cyprus wasn't just a minor player in the late Bronze Age Mediterranean. Quote, we often overlook Cyprus, but it's really crucial, and it's really right there in the center of everything, end quote, she says. Quote, it's mediating a lot of these exchanges, but it's also developing its own local culture at the same time, end quote. Knapp agrees that signs are pointing to a bigger role for the island kingdom. Quote, the more we know about Cyprus, the clearer it becomes that it wasn't just a go-between, end quote, he says. The end. This is Paul, and I'll be reading a National Geographic article written by Avery Schuller Nunn, entitled, The Most Eco-Friendly Way to Shop for Clothes, According to Fashion Experts. The fashion industry directly contributes to climate change and plastic pollution. It generates anywhere from 4 to 10% of global carbon emissions, and in 2019, one study estimated that the fashion industry alone created 8.3 million tons of plastic pollution. Cheaply and quickly made clothes, a business model known as fast fashion, is driving the increase in the fashion industry's environmental footprint, according to a scientific review published in the journal Nature in 2020. To understand what that means for people, wildlife, and the planet, we spoke with Emma Hawkinson, founding director of Collective Fashion Justice, and Karen Pearson, a chemist at the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York City. They explained what, quote, fast fashion, end quote, really means, and how consumers and institutions alike can respond. None. How do you define fashion, and why is it so environmentally harmful? Hankinson. It's about the quantity and pace at which fashion is produced. We used to make clothing that was tailored specifically to a person, and they wore that clothing for years. Now we have 52, if not more, quote, micro-seasons, end quote, in the fashion world. Research from the Hot or Cool Institute says that Western consumers can only afford, within planetary boundaries, to buy 5 newly made garments a year. Many consumers are buying 10 times more than that. Fashion as a concept can be about style and expressing yourself as an individual. But this system prioritizes profit over longevity and creativity. Pearson. Fast fashion is about a lack of adhering to the traditional 4 to 6 annual season cycle in favor of high-volume, low-cost production. It's this large number of, quote, seasons, end quote, and collections that make it, quote, fast, end quote. We are producing way more than is needed and doing it cheaply. None. Sustainable fashion, by contrast, is often criticized as financially inaccessible. Is that perception accurate? How can people with limited income buy more sustainably made clothes? Hankinson. Ethical fashion is more expensive. Paying a living wage and protecting land and labor costs more. We have to reconsider the true, quote, cost, end quote, of clothing, which is why I also really encourage people to try to make their own clothing at least once, because you will quickly realize that there's a reason why ethically made garments cost more. But the most sustainable way to dress is not to buy new things, as everyone has access to that. Fast fashion isn't sustained by people with limited income. It's driven by high-volume consumption among those with disposable income. It's important to acknowledge the reality of who funds the fast fashion. And it's important to not let luxury fashion off the hook. It can also be made in a way that is sustainable, that is unsustainable, and unethical, just at a high price point. Pearson. Well-made, higher-quality clothing often comes with greater transparency in the supply chain. It can cost more up front, but it's designed to last longer, so the cost balances out over time. The growth of second-hand market has also made high-quality, even luxury fashion far more accessible at lower price points. By buying second-hand, you extend a garment's life and reduce its overall carbon footprint. For people on a tight budget, the most responsible choice may simply buy one versatile, durable piece instead of 5 cheaper ones. None. Thrifting is widely seen as a climate-friendly alternative. Is it truly as sustainable as it appears? Hankinson. It's encouraging that buying vintage and second-hand has become more popular. It's one of the most sustainable ways to shop, and historically, it was driven by economic necessity, not trend. But even when shopping secondhand, it's important not to carry over a fast fashion mindset. If we treat resale like an endless cycle, buying heaps of items we don't truly love because we can always resell them, we overlook the environmental cost of shipping and repeated consumption. Vintage shopping works best when it's curated and intentional, asking, quote, do I really need this, or do I just want it, end quote. That said, it's still far more responsible than buying something brand new that requires fresh resources to be extracted from the earth. Pearson, when you donate high-quality clothing that still has life in it, you're often supporting local nonprofits and community partners who rely on resale to fund programs for marginalized groups. The problem is donating low-quality clothing that can't be resold. Much of that excess ends up shipped to countries in the global south, where it can overwhelm local markets and waste systems, essentially exporting our textile waste abroad. That's why donation quality matters, and why we also need stronger textile recycling systems at home for items that truly can't be worn again. None. People are exposed to so many trends on social media. How can we as consumers avoid the social pressure? Hankinson. Foster your own sense of style and step off the trend cycle. Just because something is being marketed as essential doesn't mean it's right for you. And the best way to avoid the environmental cost of, quote, keeping up, end quote, is to shop your own wardrobe first. Buying fewer clothes is the single most important thing we can do to limit our climate impact. After all, material choices matter because most of a garment's footprint comes from its raw materials. Animal-derived fibers like leather, wool, and cashmere can carry especially high methane impacts, while fossil fuel-based synthetics also come with significant costs. Pearson. I try to think about my wardrobe as a whole and choose pieces that are generally versatile. The best items are the ones you can dress up or down. I have a simple black sweater wrap I've worn to a black tie event, to regular work meetings, and even to a bonfire with jeans. By just changing accessories and styling, the same pieces work in completely different settings, focusing on that kind of versatility means you need fewer clothes overall and get far more use out of what you own. None. What do you think of clothing rental services? Do these models meaningfully reduce environmental impact? End quote. Hankinson. Rental can be a really good tool for special events, but it shouldn't reinforce the idea that you need something new every time. It's fine to have one special event dress that you own and wear. And I do think it's important that those business models operate in a way that's fair to the consumer, because sometimes rentals are so expensive, people might feel as though they may as well just buy something new that's cheaper. Pearson. It can be a strong option, as it allows you to wear items that would carry a high carbon footprint if purchased new. But without long-term ownership, while shipping and packaging can raise environmental concerns, some companies are improving their systems with reusable garment bags and minimal waste. Overall, these evolving business models are encouraging. They show real progress toward reducing the carbon impact of textiles, while giving consumers more flexible, lower-waste ways to access fashion. None. When you decide to buy something new, what standards or principles guide that choice and your approach? Hankinson. I adhere to the rule of 5 new garments a year. Anything else has to be vintage or secondhand. Beyond that, I will not buy new clothes unless I know that they are made by a person who is paid a living wage, which about 2% of the clothes makers aren't. I want to know what the fiber is, and I won't buy products made from fossil fuel materials. Pearson. My entire wardrobe is filled with things that would loosely be defined as classics. If I'm buying something, I'm looking for something that is of higher quality and that will provide multiple functions. If you can keep a garment in use for a longer period of time, you reduce its carbon footprint dramatically. If there's something I would only wear a handful of times, it doesn't take up real estate in my closet. I choose things that will have a longer life and are made out of higher quality materials. The end.